Hey there, podcast listener. In order to keep our show free to download, we have to remove the full versions of the songs that we listen to during the interviews. But if you want to hear this episode in its entirety, go to threesongstories.org or just download the WGCU app to your phone and find us there.
One, two, three.
Welcome to Three Song Stories, the place where music meets memory and storytelling ensues. Thanks for listening. I'm Mike Canary. My guest today is Justin Anderson. Justin's a third-generation Fort Myers native. He's the son of the late and honorable Judge Isaac Anderson Jr. and Audria Anderson, who played a key role in the foundation and formation of Florida Gulf Coast University, where we record this show. Justin graduated from Fort Myers High School in 1996. He then earned English Literature and Women and Gender Studies degrees at Princeton University. He also got a degree in American Studies from Florida State University and his law degree from University of Florida. Justin spent the first 15 years of his career in secondary education as an English teacher, administrator, and coach. He's lived all over the U.S., as well as South Africa, and most recently in China. He's currently living back in Fort Myers, running a consulting business. Well, I didn't know Justin in school. I, too, went to Fort Myers High, but he was more than 4 years behind me. He does come highly recommended as a Three Song Stories guest from one of my previous victims, Amy Ware. After her episode, she was like, "You got to get Justin Anderson on the show." So here we go. Hey there, Justin Anderson. I'm glad I can make you laugh with the opener.
It was great. It was great.
Nice to meet you.
Great to meet you. Great to be here. Thank you.
Cool. What was the musical background of your childhood?
Oh, man. The musical background of my childhood, oddly enough, was AM radio. When I was very, very, very young, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people talk about their childhood with you know, that big, huge, like, armoire-looking piece of a radio
turntable. Yeah.
Like, my grandmother had one of those in South Carolina. And, you know, they'd talk about listening to gospel music or talk about listening to blues or jazz or something. My mother, while she was raised in that in South Carolina, you know, here in Florida growing up, you know, you had the radio. Mm-hmm. And back in the early 80s, you know, the FM had the great rock and roll stations and stuff. But my mom, being a good Christian woman, said no. Rock and roll is the devil's music. Now, I will say I don't believe my mother, you know, truly believes that. I think she was trying to
– She was trying to buffer.
Yeah, trying to buffer her children from being exposed to – So we listened to a lot of AM stuff. So, I mean, America, Kansas, I mean, you know, Simon and Garfunkel, stuff comes – I kid you not. Like, people look at me because I know all the words to Bread, you know, and they're just like –
You're the second person who's brought up Bread. Last time I was like, I don't even know who Bread is, but now I do because of a previous guest. This is great.
Exactly. They're one of those groups you know, but you don't know.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, That's right. So there was no – or was there any records spinning around the house or anything like that?
You know, my mom's younger sister, Angela, my Aunt Angela, who a lot of – she's back in South Carolina, but she grew up – she kind of grew up with me because, you know, she was the youngest of eight kids, but she was only – about 16 years older than me. So she went to Cypress Lake High when I was born. So she kind of took care of – because, you know, my mom, career woman, working.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it was over at Edison Community College, now Florida Southwestern.
I was a student there when she was a teacher there, by the
really?
Way.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
See,
my roots are deep.
The funny thing is that because she – you know, she taught in the 70s. She did administration for most of the 80s, but then she taught again in the 90s.
Yeah.
So I'll be with her in public, and she'll get this weird mix of – And, you know, because it's community college, you could be a 40-year-old in her class in 1975.
Yeah, yeah.
Or you could be a 45-year-old in her class in 1992.
Yeah.
And so now, you know, she gets all different kinds of ages of people. Hey, I was in your class. And it's always funny to watch her try to piece them together. But no, my aunt always played a lot of gospel music. You know, she was very religious. So she played gospel music when she would have us, you know, cleaning the house when she was babysitting for us and all that kind of stuff. So.
What's the earliest musical memory you can recall or the first thing that flashes into your brain when I ask that question?
Being 5 years old and getting a set of drums for my birthday from Heather Harsh, and my dad, quote unquote, accidentally stepping on them in the middle of the night. I believe this was not an accident. This was a conspiracy. Because,
like stepping on destroying?
Yeah, yeah. Like he's stepping. He claims, oh, you left your toys out. You know, I went to get a drink of water in the middle of the night and I accidentally stepped on them. You know, the typical story. And, you know, as a kid, I'm sure I believed it. But now as an adult, when I think back to somebody giving a five-year-old a drum set as a present, I mean, my God, that's kind of torturous, you know.
Did you play musical instruments at all in your life?
I did. My mother steered me away from the drums. In middle school, I played trumpet.
Fort Myers Middle. Go Ripples.
Yeah, Go Ripples. Mr. Hansen, the band director, who he might still be the band director.
Yeah. Can you remember the first time that music moved you?
Yes. And, you know, one of the songs that I was going to put on my list, it was interesting. I took it off. This list was very difficult to make.
Mm-hmm. You're not alone, Justin.
Yeah. I mean, for me as a kid, like I said, my mom is from South Carolina. My dad grew up here, you know, in Fort Myers. So, you know, I grew up Christmas and summers going to South Carolina to stay at my grandmother's house. And so, you know, that's a 700-mile drive. And, you know, we would listen to tapes in the radio and not the radio but tapes. And we always listened to like oldies tapes, you know, the ones you get for like $4.99 at the gas station.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like greatest hits of like 1966, greatest hits of 1968, R&B. So we're talking a great mix of R&B but also rock and roll. So Hugh Masekela's Grazing in the Grass was on one of those tapes. And, oh, man, like that, it just, you know, it's an instrumental. And you don't really, as a kid, you know, an 8-9-year-old kid, you don't really get into instrumentals. But that really spoke to me. And that actually helped my mother convince me to play trumpet in middle school.
Hmm.
So, that song for sure.
Did you ever make mixtapes?
Definitely. I mean, who, you know. As a kid in the 90s, how can you not, you know, listen up, millennials. I mean, you had to – life was rough. You had to have your radio and your boombox, and you had to have your blank tape in the cassette player ready.
Yeah.
So that when you heard the lead in for a good song and you had to wait for the DJ to stop talking to hit record to get – I mean, oh, man. Like, I mean, the blood, sweat, and tears that went into making a good mixtape.
Whew. Did you ever give away a mixtape or get a mixtape?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know what they do now. You tag friends in certain songs you like or whatever. But,
well, and I guess they make playlists now,
yeah,
like Spotify playlists or something.
But
it's not the same,
easy.
Right?
It's too – I mean, yeah, I get it. You're thinking about that person or whatever.
Yeah,
but
before, like you said, it was so mechanical.
Oh, the effort.
And the effort. And the writing, the tracks on the little insert and all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, in those days, you actually – I looked forward to reading liner notes.
I really did.
I mean, you learned a lot about, you know, obviously the music business has changed because of technology for good and bad reasons. I think overall for good because of access to a wider audience and access for artists. You don't have to be controlled by the big corporate machine. But that big corporate machine was really good about promoting those artists and letting you know, get to know those artists in a way that they wanted you to. That way you became not just a fan of like that particular song but of the music. So like I think what's interesting about the three songs that I have, and I actually listened last night to the albums that they're on, I find it emblematic that each of those songs are on albums that I can just play, just put on play and just let it run.
That's actually one of my questions that I was going to ask later. So, you know, how many albums or what is the album that you can always listen to straight through? And all three of your song choices today come from albums like that?
They do. But I think that they do, and that's because of what we were just talking about, that era, you know, the 80s and 90s of music making. But for me, this is going to sound weird. I actually don't listen to those albums very regularly. Those songs, though, I will listen to. But in terms of, you know, like an album that I would just put in, you know, it kind of depends on, you know, the artist's mood. You know, most recently, my music tastes are eclectic. So most recently, I've been into electronica. So anything by Cut Copy, Neon Indian. Who I actually got to see Neon Indian in Beijing, which was really awesome. Other groups like Chromeo and stuff like that. Like some of their albums, like totally I can put in start to finish. But, you know, Chicago, like that's another great group.
What a great pivot.
Yeah, I know. I told you, eclectic. I'm just like, oh.
When you played these albums through last night, were they on CDs or what? How do you listen to your music? And when was
Spotify.
Last – Spotify.
Yeah.
So when was the last time you bought physically form music?
The last time I – That's a great question. Oh, man. The last time I bought
– Not recently.
A piece of music in physical form that was just music would have been in 2009. And the reason why I remember this is because I was living in South Africa at the time. So, you know, music portability was an issue, and so it was kind of like if you wanted something, you still kind of – I mean, in South Africa in 2009 was definitely farther behind us. So,
yeah. You weren't –
you're buying CDs.
Yeah. What was the album? Yeah. Would you remember?
Yeah. Honestly, no, because at that point I was just trying to entertain myself. I mean, I would just go to the mall and I would buy anything I could find up musically, and then I would buy DVDs of – anything and just literally watch anything because we were in a cottage. This is when I was doing summer or study abroad in law school at UF. They have a wonderful program connected to Cape Town. The TV in the cottage we had, the owners, because, you know, Europeans, this is like their summer cottage. So they turn off their cable. So all we had was, you know, I guess South Africa's version of PBS,
right,
which was cool. But because South Africa has like 11 official languages, only about 20% of the time
it wasn't totally
it was in
accessible.
English. Yeah. So half the time it was kind of like, what? Oh, something's on in English.
Okay. Well, let's get to your first song. What do you have for us?
So the first song is Billy Ocean, When the Going Gets Tough. I went in a chronological order in terms of obviously when the songs came out, but also I guess in my maturation process, just person, music taste, whatever. But also I think what's interesting is that it's, you know, the songs start from when I was about, you know, probably 7 or 8 years old until I'm 16. And this is something that I have been aware of since college, and I would talk to my friends about this in conversations about, you know, do we allow ourselves to have our tastes evolve as we get older, or do we stick to that same core, you know, group of music for the rest of our lives? And then also let's look at how does, you know, technology influence us? And this is something I've carried that conversation on to my students when I taught high school. And I would, you know, I'd explain to them because these are children that have grown up in a time where, you know, they've always had instant access to music.
Correct.
They've always, you know, it's always been digital. They know what a CD is, but they've never really used one and they don't own any. I still have in my closet my magazines,
your books.
Exactly. And I asked them, I said, you know, or I described to them things that we experience, that collective experience, you know, when there's a song, say in a popular movie or in a popular television commercial. A great example of this was when I was in college and Mazda had their commercial. A group of us were watching a Super Bowl. It's about 50 of us in a room. And, you know, this is Princeton University. We're from everywhere, literally around the world.
Yeah.
And Mazda used Crazy Train for the soundtrack, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And without fail, everybody in the room on cue,
Yeah.
And we all looked at each other like, really?
Collective you know? Consciousness.
Yeah. And when I describe that to teenagers today, they're like, first of all, what is okay. Yeah. We'll leave that for another discussion. But I think it's a great thing that there's wider access to music and artists don't have to be bound by the corporate overlords of music.
Mm-hmm.
But we've lost that collective consciousness.
And that sort of real-timeness of some of it too, in a way.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, well, let's hear this song. This is When the Going Gets Tough by Billy Ocean from his 1986 album Love Zone. It's Justin Anderson's first song today on this episode of Three Song Stories. I got something to tell you. I got something to say. Okay, so where does that take you? Because it takes me to eighth grade dance at Fort Myers Middle School. What about you? What is the crystallization of that song and a memory that comes together?
Honestly, it's the weird thing about this song, it takes me a lot of different places because to me, like this song and the biggest reason why I picked this song is because it is a representation of what made songs in the 80s awesome. It had like everything from, you know, call and response, you know, those amazing backup singers. You know, you've got the saxophone in there.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got that synthesizer going. I mean, it just – it's like an 80s anthem.
I was going to say it's definitely anthemic.
Yes, 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 yes. And I mean, you know, I mean, it's just so strange because to me, this song for me is always an uplifting, energetic, get up and go. Like if you, to me, I always see it as like if you're faced with obstacles, you know, you can work hard and overcome them. You just keep going. Now that's kind of interesting. Listening to the full album version, because I grew up, you know, with the radio
edit. Hearing the 3 minute and 40 second version instead of the 5 minute and 40.
And this version, you know, as I said, I'm like, wow, this is a lot more erotic than I remembered when I was 8 years old.
Well, you may have just been selectively hearing what made sense to you.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. You know, and so it just. Yeah, I mean, it's definitely the kind of song that, you know, while it doesn't necessarily remind me of any one particular place, it definitely reminds me of my dad a lot. You know, the 80s and my dad, you know, I was very much, we spent a lot of time together. You know, he loved watching like those crazy 80s movies.
Oh, yeah.
I remember when, so New Year's, we went out as a family and Spies Like Us was in a theater and Amadeus was in a theater. My mother,
she went over and saw Amadeus.
And of course, you know, the plan was we were going to – and a lot of you old school Fort Myers, South Fort Myers remember this because we lived in Principia.
Right. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I knew people who lived in there, yeah.
And we went to Dino's Pizza right in front of South Point Cinema.
Uh-huh. Before it was a $1.50 theater.
Exactly. And we walked. You know, we walked from our house. We walked over to Dino's and we, you know, walked over to South Point. So the plan was to go to see Amadeus, which, you know, my mother – culture, you know, instill some culture in the kids. My dad said, no, I'm going to see Spies Like Us. And I, in that moment, you know, this was like a pivotal moment in my life. I was like, can I be the good little cultured boy, go with mom and my brother and see Amadeus? Or it sounds like my dad's going to see this really cool movie with like Chevy Chase that I think is going to be funny that I have no business seeing at 7 years old. But somehow dad's going to let me go. So, you know, we went in and seeing it and it was an amazing movie. It was so funny.
It delights me to imagine your dad loving Spies Like Us. It delights me.
Our favorite film to watch was Raising Arizona. My dad... I mean, he just said, it's a piece of Americana. He said, I don't care who you are, that if you want to tell somebody about America, you have them watch that movie right there. His favorite line, you know, is
blow up into funny shapes?
Holly. I guess if you figure circular's funny. Holly Hunter's famous, give me that baby, you warthog from hell. You know, I mean, he would just sometimes say that around the house. You know, I mean, we that one, Coming to America, I'm going to get you, sucker. Like, I mean, these are films that I feel like a lot of people, you know, who knew my dad, you always knew him as just
yeah, absolutely.
The judge.
Yeah, this is definitely.
Laying down the law and da, 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 da. But they, little did they know.
Oh, that's hilarious. When was the last time you did karaoke?
I do karaoke often.
Oh, yeah?
I do.
What's your go-to?
My
go-tos.
See, so I have a whole –
We're on another whole list now.
I've got a whole other list. Now, you know, we start off with some Bob Seger, you know, maybe some Turn the Page, warm up those vocal cords, do something fun, like Fat Bottom Girls.
Queen at karaoke?
Of course. Like, of course. Because nobody's really like, you know, hey, look, Fat Bottom Girls is an awesome song.
Hey, yeah.
And nobody sees it coming.
Oh, yeah.
And I always like to throw people a curveball. And the other great curveball song I love to sing is I love to sing Tim McGraw. Because there's always somebody in the audience. Always. I've done this here in Fort Myers. I've done this in Los Angeles when I lived in LA. There's always somebody who comes up to me after a Tim McGraw song, just so confused, saying, "You sound just like him, but," and I'm like, "But what?" You know, and I used to sing as a child. I sang in church choir.
Okay.
I took voice lessons as an adult. I'm going to put in a plug for Tara, my voice teacher out in Los Angeles. She's actually in Montrose, which is outside of Pasadena, and her music school, the Hummingbird Conservatory. She's amazing. I mean, I'm going to tell you this quick story. She's amazing because I was taking singing lessons from Tara while she was just starting her business. I was 30, whatever, five or, you know, however, and her other clients were like 11 and 13. And I was in a recital and everything. You know, I'm 35 years old in my suit. The next girl singing was 11. The next girl was like 15 or something. But I was, you know, I prepared the year and had my songs. And so what was funny at the end of it though, is because, you know, there were probably like 20 people there. It was like their mothers and uncles and cousins and whoever. And then me, this guy. And so this one older lady who I think was the grandmother of one of the other girls singing comes up to me. I don't know to say something, but I'm just caught up in the moment. So I end up hugging her as well. Hey, it's a great moment. We all did great in our recital.
You know, when I asked our mutual friend Amy Ware the question of when was the last time you did karaoke, she said, 4 hours ago.
That's pretty accurate.
Which was funny because it was like 5:15 in the afternoon on a Saturday.
Yeah, so, that was pretty accurate. Yeah.
Yeah. So dancing, does dancing fit into your life?
It does. I enjoy dancing. I know people who are listening to this who have – had the joy of seeing me at a wedding or maybe even invited me to their wedding knows very well that I enjoy dancing because I will dance with anyone and everyone, including grandma. Grandma doesn't get a pass. She's always one of the first people that I get on the dance floor. So yeah, I do enjoy dancing. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Well, let's move on to your second song.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yes. So the second song is by Smashing Pumpkins, 1979, from their album Melancholy and Infinite Sadness. This song, I remember, still remember buying this album.
Yeah.
Exactly. I bought this album from the old, like, it's like an old little, used buy and sell record store on Cypress Lake Drive by 41. It's now like a Japanese restaurant or something
like
that.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
But yeah, I still remember that the night, because it was the day it came out, I bought it that night because I was so excited for this album. Smashing Pumpkins, their previous album – well, not their previous album, but their previous larger commercial success, Disarm, Siamese Dream with Disarm and a lot of Rocket and a lot of other great, you know, Today, all those great songs on that. So I was really geared up. And then I knew, you know, it was going to be a double CD set. This is amazing. Like I said, I listened last night. It's a double CD set and you can press play on disc one. And even at 16, when I bought this album, I would just go through the first disc. Finish it, take it out, put in the second. And, you know, there's some – I mean, Smashing Pumpkins, there are some gnarly songs on
there.
Yeah,
yeah.
But because groups were so used to making albums, they all fit.
Right.
I mean, I wouldn't hand somebody this album and tell them start off with one of the – you kind of – and because they're albums, the gnarlier songs are like tracks 10, 11. You know, I mean, they work you up to it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they don't just kind of clobber you over the head and, you know, the other thing – a little thing about technology that's kind of weird too is introductions in albums. So like when you use vinyl, even though I won't say I'm too young for vinyl. I just technologically speaking, we didn't have vinyl in my house.
Right.
We just listened to the radio and tapes. And then bought CDs when I had my own money. But even on CDs, like back in the 90s, you had intro tracks that you couldn't necessarily skip and that you now kind of discover with Spotify and all these other, you know, online. You're like, oh, that's a whole other track. I thought that was just the beginning of this song. And so Melancholy and Infinite Sadness is an excellent example because the opening, the intro, which is titled Melancholy, you know, really is about 2 minutes, 45 seconds that leads you into Tonight, which was a big commercial hit for them. If they came out with this album today, you would never hear that intro.
Right.
But it's strange to me now to hear Tonight without that intro.
Right.
So because I know there's a good and the intro is beautiful. I mean it's really a piece of symphonic music that was written to help ease you into
Put you in the right mindset.
The rock and roll of the album.
Right.
Which I think is one of the genius things about the album. It starts with a piece of symphonic music. And it's like a hard rock album. I mean, it's wild.
You know, until I looked it up to put it on this script so I could read it to you, I didn't realize that the title of the album was Melon Space Colly.
Mm-hmm.
I was never a huge Smashing Pumpkins fan, so I
Melon,
never
– Mellon,
M-E-L-L-O-N. Oh, and Colly, yeah.
Colly, C-O-L-L-I-E.
Yeah.
So then you can really start to look in the meaning of, you know, are they just talking about the melon as a fruit? And then obviously if we think of melon as a fruit that's outside of the meaning of fruit, our first thought goes to melon as referring to head, right?
Right.
And then Colly, C-O-L-L-I, you know, the dog, not – you know, the one word melancholy isn't
right.
Sadness.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so you're thinking when you first say, oh, melancholy and infinite, like, wow, this guy's really, 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 really sad.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You're like, wait a minute.
No, I couldn't believe my eyes when I pulled it up on the screen.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is 1979 by the Smashing Pumpkins from their 1996 album, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness. You're listening to Three Song Stories. It's biography through music. Watching you listen to that, it was like you had your eyes closed and it was like viscerally pleasing to you. I could just see it.
It was. I, you know, that song, yeah, man. You know, I think that song, I think it was widely popular for a number of reasons. I think, you know, obviously commercially it's a great song. But, you know, if you really, you know, pay attention to the words – you know, they're really talking about kind of like that outsider culture, which we saw beginning to emerge in the 90s. You know, obviously, I'd say it's weird to say this, but the mainstream kind of leader of that, I guess, arguably could have been Kurt Cobain. And, you know, Smashing Pumpkins was along in that same vein.
Sure.
And I think what is so important about music is that, you know, it speaks to universal truths. And this song is speaking to that universal truth of teenage angst, but it's speaking to it in the sense of that was relevant to the end of the 20th century, the end of the millennium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, we were you know, finishing high school, some of us going to college, some of us going to work, some of us going to the army, some of us, most of us not really knowing, well, really none of us really knowing what was going to happen in the future. And that's, you know, that's a sense that I think most high school kids have. But, you know, this is a time in our history where we were just beginning to see the explosion of the internet.
Right.
We're just beginning to see technology changing the face of our existence
right.
in a way that has never been seen in history.
Big leap forward from the increments from
before. So for us, on some sort of subconscious level, we were like, we're going to be the ones in charge of this ridiculousness, you know? So it's kind of almost on this very deep level, having this feeling of there's this huge wave coming at you and you don't know what you're going to do about it. But then also kind of on the surface level, there's that, you know, hey, I'm a kid. I still want to have fun. And, you know, which I think, you know, you can see that in the beat of the song, in the music of the song. You know, it's a very kind of upbeat, you know, I mean, when you said you were watching, I was taken right back to senior year, you know, after school, going to a friend's house, beach week, you know, like all those, you know, going out to Conrad Kiesel's fishing shack in Pine Island Sound.
I know the Kiesels.
All that, yeah, all that crazy stuff you do when you're a teenager and you've kind of – but not just a teenager, like you're a senior. So it's like you've finished all the things that you're supposed to kind of do. You're almost graduating or you've just graduated.
You've got that window of anything
goes. Of like you're kind of an adult. Yeah. You can do a lot of stuff, but you don't really have any responsibility. I mean it's a heady time.
Hmm. Do you have a favorite band?
Like you mean of like all time?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Like – oh, this is really – okay. If I had to pick a favorite group – a group where I probably know, you know, 99% of all the words of all the songs they've ever written. Indigo Girls.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah. I know.
You said eclectic earlier in this conversation.
I did. And, you know, I've listened to them. I've loved them since I was 15.
Have you seen them live?
I had an opportunity to see them live once in Santa Monica, but I had to go to my friend Emma Swashe's birthday at the Hollywood Bowl to see Harold and Bell. I don't know. It's a group.
Harold and Bell.
I don't know. It's a group. It's a group. A lot of people like them. Not my cup of tea. My friend's birthday. So no.
But you were doing the right thing for your friend.
I was doing the right thing.
What's your favorite concert experience of the ones that you've had?
Oh man, that's a great. I don't go to a lot of concerts. I'm very with music. I'm a private person with music. I love music. I love all different kinds of music. I love finding music in different places. So I don't really concerts. And you know, I'm definitely a fan of studio music, which is interesting because that's kind of a little bit of a segue into my third song, the featured artist on my third song is Lauryn Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And Lauryn Hill, okay, so this goes back to your other question about the album that didn't make the cut, that could have made the cut, or song.
Right.
It would have been one of Lauryn Hill's songs.
Okay.
From The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. Like that album, which came out in 1999. I mean, it's 20 years later, or 98, I think. 20 years later, it's still mind-blowing, just amazing, start to finish, musically, the message, masterful. But she's not exactly the person you want to see in concert. And only because I've heard from friends of mine who've paid to go see her several times, she shows up like 3 hours late. When she does, like the songs don't resemble anything. I mean, you know, there's a studio and then there's a concert, but you know, she does like weird renditions.
Not into that.
I'm not, and I just don't want to be in that position. I don't want to go to a concert and, you know. Now, when I saw Neon Indian in Beijing, that was just more of a show. That was like a show at a little club. That was absolutely amazing because, you know, China doesn't really do American music.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, yeah. I wanted to pick your brain about what the musical stylings and scene is like there for you. And how long were you there?
So I was in Beijing for a year and was working for an American company over there, an education company. And I didn't know any Chinese when I moved there. I was recruited for the job. Most of my employees and co-workers, you know, the company, like I'd say 60% Chinese, 40% American. So, I mean, English was spoken at work.
Sure.
But because I was head of my division, I sat through literally 4 hours of meetings all in Chinese every day. So I learned some and you know all that. But what I found about the music industry there, they have their own thing. And you know what's interesting, I mentioned Chromeo. My buddy Kevin Kosher used to be their manager, and I talked to him about this before I went over there. I was like, "Hey, you know, would you guys come over there?" Well, he wasn't working with them then, but he said no, and he explained to me. He said, "You know, China does their own thing because most of the American groups are big in Japan, or they're big in Vietnam, or they're big in Thailand." And well, what are the two things that link them? Oh, well, because that's where American military bases are.
Oh.
Never had an American military base in China.
Yeah, yeah, that's
so you've got 1.7 billion people who've only just recently been exposed to American music, whereas in Japan
– And they're being exposed to American music because of technology and the internet.
Yeah, now it's technology.
Because of boots on the ground, literally.
Well, partly. I mean, because they do control the internet.
Then. Yeah, well.
I mean, they shut it off. Like when they – for 2 weeks in March 2016 – didn't matter if you had a VPN or what. I mean, they just whoop. For just those 2 weeks, I couldn't use Google. I couldn't use Facebook. I couldn't get on anything that I could get on with a VPN.
What did that feel like for someone who by then was totally used to total connectivity? Was that kind of shocking?
There's a lot of shocking things about China. a lot of shocking things. And the most shocking thing about China, which I really – wish I could impress upon my friends here who've never been, the smell in Beijing.
Mm-hmm.
I there's just got to be a technology where you can like tell people, describe to people the smells. But that's a whole other.
Is it the pollution side of the smell? Or
yeah,
is it
it's
the
pollution. I mean, it's a pollution. Beijing is a city with 25 million people.
Yeah.
Pollution. And when I say Americans don't grasp. Americans mention smog. I'm like, Americans do not know what smog is. On a good day, okay, I didn't have to wear a mask and the pollution was five times the worst pollution in America.
Right, right.
And that's a good day.
Yeah, that was clear day.
Oh, yeah. Bad days, I was on the 27th floor of a building. I could not see the high rise next to me and the alley across from us.
I heard an interview on public radio at some point over the past year, and they were asking somebody who was an exchange student from China who had come here for the first time, and his first impression was how blue the sky was.
Mm-hmm.
Like he couldn't believe the sky was that blue because he had grown up in whether Beijing or one of the big cities, and I thought that was really kind of an interesting way to crystallize.
Yeah, no,
the difference.
It was interesting because when I went there in 2015. The recession just started. So the factories were still up and running, but by the time winter hit, the recession was in full swing and the factories had stopped. So what was kind of interesting is that in the winter in Beijing, Beijing is in a big – it's like a bowl surrounded by mountains. So when those factories are pumping all that smoke, it just gets trapped. But in the winter – because we're on this high plain and it's very, very cold but very, very dry and there's a lot of wind, you know. So while there's a lot of pollution that hangs above the top, that lower level sometimes the wind kind of blows it through. Well, as the recession got worse and the factory shut down, we actually had really nice days in the spring of 2016. But I had to remind myself, oh, wait, that's because there's a recession. Factories haven't been running for like a week or something like that. And because there's like, you know, people crowding into the education industry. So like I had to kind of adjust in my job because, you know, in China it's a bit different from America where, you know, if you were a factory worker and your factory shut down, you know, you would just kind of pivot – the word they like to say today, put up a sign on a door and say, hey, I'm an education consultant. I help your kid get into school in America. And, you know, they will copy everything they see. Like China's wild. I mean, it is the wild, wild west. It is the most capitalist place
I've
ever
been to in my life. It's so ironically the opposite.
It is completely opposite from what most Americans who've never been there think. Money talks and BS walks. You know, I mean, businesses, we would have to be careful about, you know, we would have, you know, presentations where American schools would come to our office, do a presentation for prospective families. But we would have to be very careful about who we would invite to the office, who we would let in, because other agents would come to our office, take pictures and replicate it somewhere else in town. I mean, that's China. Like and there's no better business bureau. There's no agency to stop
anybody. And
there's
clearly no Clean Air Act.
No. It's I mean, it is a free for all. You have to be quick, smart, and whatever it is that you're doing, you know, just you can make money, keep doing that, just kind of try to do it better. I mean, they as a culture, I learned so much, you know, about not just Chinese culture, but perspectives in culture and how you view world events. You know, because when I got there, they were celebrating the 70th anniversary of defeating the Japanese. Mm-hmm. Of course, to us, we're like, yay, we won World War II. You know, to them, they're like, what? Like they weren't even thinking anything about America or Normandy or any, you know, they're talking about, no, the Japanese who've been oppressing us for like hundreds of years and we finally beat them. To which most Americans have no idea.
Yeah.
The history between Japan and China. No idea. So yeah, but musically though, getting back to the music, the most fascinating thing was I had a friend who one of my roommates was a Harvard grad student studying ancient Chinese. So he had his grad student circle of friends and we would go to dinner once a week. And one of his friends was studying Chinese opera. So I got to talk to her about Chinese opera. Now, musically, not a fan of Chinese opera. I can appreciate what they're doing, just not a fan. So it was great to talk to her about and ask her all these different questions and learn a bit more. And, you know, from my experience, I never – because, you know, I didn't speak any Chinese, we didn't have we had a television, but it wasn't connected to, you know, cable television or anything like that. So I was not exposed to Chinese music very regularly. I had to kind of seek it out, which I did, like with my friend with the Chinese. She invited me to Chinese opera, which I respectfully declined because I knew I would not be able to survive that whole thing. But like I heard, you know, she would send me clips of things and that, stuff like that. But that gets me to another kind of interesting technology thing. I'm old school in that when I buy something, I take care of it and I keep it forever. That's not good for the technological age because they obviously make things to be disposable.
Correct. Yeah.
When I got to China in 2015, I still had my first edition iPod that held some crazy amount, like 180 gigs or something crazy like that, right? And I remember I got that iPod for Christmas in 2000, I think it was 5, I want to say. So I'd had this thing for 10 years. Now, being a pack rat helped me because I get to China and obviously I'm in China. I have no cell service. There's no, you know, no Wi-Fi. I don't read Chinese, so I can't, you know, I don't have a phone. Eventually, I got a phone and I got like some Wi-Fi and all that kind of stuff. But then again, what I realized was it's a lot easier for me and a lot cheaper to walk around with my little iPod that's got these 100 gigs of memory and music on it, you know, which was my first iPod. My coworker who was this millennial literally picked it up and was like, what is this? I said, what do you mean? It's an iPod. I said, what do you mean? Because, you know, it was – there were like – they looked – they were bigger than like a baseball card and had a little screen on it.
Yep.
It was a pretty big device. And he turned it over and he looked at it. And,
it had a heft.
You probably like you could hold it and hold it in your hand. I got big hands. You can feel it like a real thing. And he turned it over and said 120 gig. He's like, that's like an operating system. It's like, yeah, and it's almost completely full. He's like, really? You have that much music on there? And I was like, yes, I do. And so it served me being in Beijing. So when I would walk around in Beijing to not hear the city noise and a lot of Chinese that I didn't understand anyway, I would just listen to music. And so even though this loops back to your question about the internet, even though I was in a place where they could shut off the internet – even when I had the internet, it was still very spotty. It's not like America where I've got internet everywhere unless I'm in some sort of field. I mean, I was in the middle of the largest city in the country and routinely in my apartment, I would just be like, wait for it. You know, trying to watch something on Netflix. Are you kidding me? It was like an hour long show. It would take you 2 hours because you're just kind of waiting for the – so having that iPod and having that stored music in China was huge.
It was your lifeline.
Yes.
Well, let's move on to your last song. I think I learned more about modern Chinese culture during the last 10 minutes than
right?
I knew before that. That's
right?
For sure. It's cool. What's your last song?
Oh, man. My last song is by Nas, and it's entitled If I Ruled the World. This, as I mentioned before, Lauryn Hill is on this track, which is amazing. I mean, you know, this track – this actually came out when I was 18, 18 or 19. And I think it was my freshman year in college. And again, dovetailing from, you know, the Smashing Pumpkins, you know, what they were kind of getting at, that teenage angst and being on the precipice of this, you know, new world of technology. There's that feeling in that. But this song actually looks more towards the past about Black people's experience here in America and looking towards the future. And it's a very hopeful song, you know, in the title, If I Ruled the World. And I picked this song because it's, again, one of those songs. When I hear it, it's just – I mean that the feeling of hope, you know, for the future and doing better, you know, not just for yourself but for your community and for the world around you. That's what the song taps into. And again, it's on that album, Illmatic, where you can just, hey, track one and let it run. Just let it go. And so I don't think that's an accident that every single one of these songs – is on an album where you can listen to, and that the singer featured on the third song also has,
yeah,
you know, an album. I don't think those are accidents.
All right. Well, this is If I Ruled the World by Nas. I know I'm so musically not inclined that I didn't.
Nas. Yes.
Nas. This is If I Ruled the World by Nas from the 1996 album It Is Written. You're listening to Three Song Stories.
Imagine smoking weed in the street without cops harassing. Imagine going to court with no trial. Lifestyle cruising blue Bahama waters. No welfare supporters. More conscious of the way we raise our daughters. Days are shorter, nights are colder. Feeling like life is over. These snakes strike like a cobra. The world's hot, my son got knocked. Evidently, it's elementary. They want us all gone eventually.
If I rule the world, if I rule the world, I free all.
What would we've asked this question before, like what would your younger self think of you now? What would your 18-year-old self think of you now? And what would your 18-year-old self think of the world now through the lens of that song as you heard it then?
Wow.
Throwing it down.
That is an amazing question. I'm an introspective person, and I have never contemplated that until this moment. Wow. My 18-year-old self, how would my 18-year-old self see the world today?
Well, let's start with how would your 18-year-old self think about where you've turned out, what you're doing in the world, person you are, the life you live, the jobs you've had.
My 18-year-old self would be really proud. Would be really proud, and really, you know, kind of amazed, mainly because, you know, and I kind of touched on this a little bit with what kind of Kurt Cobain and Smashing Pumpkins were going after. It's just like, you know, I mean, it's really rebelling against the system. And I think that and not just an overall system, but like even expectations that one might get from society, family, you know, friends, whatever that is. And you know, Nas is talking about that here in the song. You know, I mean, you know, going against those expectations really about society and what society not necessarily expects, but what society typically prejudges of a lot of Black men. You know, he starts off talking about, you know, being arrested, you know, for marijuana use. You know, it's funny listening to the song. You know, my 18-year-old self listening to this song now, you know, that first line, you know, imagine walking down the street, you know, smoking grass without being hassled by the police. hey, I witnessed that in Santa Monica in 2006 when I was teaching and coaching softball and used a local park. And there's a guy sitting on a bench smoking the fattest joint you've ever seen at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I saw a patrolman literally walk past him.
And you said that was 2006?
This was 2006.
And we've rolled a lot farther down
and
the road.
And we've gotten
since
a lot
then.
Farther
yeah.
since then. And I was standing there mouth agape, like, did this just happen? That's Santa Monica. It's California. Obviously, Nas was speaking specifically about New York. If you're up on your current events, you know, in the governor's race, you know, Cynthia Nixon has made it a center point of her campaign, you know, to legalize medical cannabis. And also she's talked about, you know, a form of, access for minorities to cash in on legalizing something that they have been disproportionately sent to prison, you know, and, my 18-year-old self, you know, being the son of the first black judge in Southwest Florida, knew all too well how this legal system preys on black men because I saw it firsthand. And I knew that I knew at 18 that I was fortunate enough to be in a situation where I was to some extent protected from that, not just because
not
of my
entirely.
Choices.
Yeah.
And, not because of my choices and my parents and having good grades and all that. It's because my father actually, because he was a judge, had to fight that directly. I mean, I can tell you stories about Lee County Sheriff's deputy stalking me as a teenager for years because I was a black guy who had the nerve to be friends with a white girl who lived across the street from him. Hmm. Okay? So I was very aware of that at 18. I was also aware of, you know, that same year, you may not remember, but that's also the year of Lords of Chaos.
No, I remember.
You know?
I wanted to ask you that. I wanted you to bring it up.
You know, hey, I was the same age as Foster.
Yeah.
You know, that he was, I hear, just as intelligent, had opportunities to go to great colleges and universities, but chose to, you know, get a group of kids together, run a gang, and go out and commit robberies and mayhem and murder.
What was that like? You know, your dad presided over that case. What was that like for you to see it through, you know, your dad's eyes and the press and all the things? Because in many ways, it was a precursor of the things we're seeing now.
Teen thrill killers. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. practically, I didn't even know it was happening. You know, my father was such an amazing judge that that entire case, and this is, you know, Kevin Foster, that entire case lasted 5 or 6 days start to finish. Court TV, I remember calling him that Friday during the trial and saying, oh, we're going to come down and Monday and Tuesday and record. And, you know, back then, Court TV was the big, you know, we didn't have all these cable news shows, right?
Right.
And my dad said to them, you better hurry up because this trial is going to be over on Monday. They're like, isn't this a capital case? And he had gone through all 14 prosecution witnesses on Thursday. Prosecution rested their case in like a day and a half.
Hmm.
You know, he was very much, you know, about being fair and speedy justice and saying, you know, this jury, they've got jobs. They've got families. They don't need to be here all day and for weeks on end. And so anyway, but that was the practical when it happened. What a lot of people don't realize is, you know, a couple years after that, after he was convicted and sentenced to death, and he's still on death row today, you know, Foster then tried to murder my dad and me and my family.
I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah. No, a lot of people don't realize that. He tried to kill us and the prosecutor and his family. This was actually – it all came to a head 4th of July weekend to – No, 1999 or 98. No, it was 98. July 4th weekend, 1998. He had conspired with his mother. She bought the weapons. The hitman that he hired was actually a reporter who worked for NBC who'd been covering the case and had visited Foster in prison over 300 times and had pretty much been brainwashed into carrying out this hit. Thankfully, at some point, he thought better of it and turned himself into the police. But this will sound strange, but there's actually a funny side to that story. I mean, people would say, is there a funny side to having somebody put a hit on you and almost kill you? Usually not. But so my father loved to fish. I mean, a lot of people know that. He loved to fish. I mean, this man, he loved fishing. I remember the day that – well, the weekend, that 4th of July weekend when this all went down, Dad was going fishing and I remember seeing him in the kitchen that morning and he just casually says to me – this is how Dad was. He just casually says, there's somebody out trying to kill us, so be aware. I'm going fishing. I mean, almost word for word, that's what he said. At like 8 o'clock, I'm like, what? And so I'm like, okay, Dad, thanks. You know, I'm like 20, you know, 21 years old, something like that. So, I mean, it's not like I'm a little kid, but it's just good to know. And when your dad is the only black judge in Southwest Florida, this isn't the first time people have tried to kill us for being black. I mean, let's be real. This is about now the fourth time in my life, and I'm only 20 years old. Dad goes fishing with a local lawyer, John Mills. They'd gone fishing hundreds of times. Now, I only heard this story at my dad's memorial service. John Mills, from his side, he's saying, well, you know, we went out fishing. We're out on the boat. The judge gets this call. And all I hear is the judge go, uh-huh, uh-huh. All right, okay. And he says, now the judge, you know, he loves fishing. He doesn't take phone calls fishing. So I knew this was something important. So John says, he asks him, the judge, well, who is that? He says, police. What do they want? Don't they know it's your day off? It's 4th of July weekend. You're out here fishing. Well, you know, some guy, they're trying to kill me. And they caught them all and it's all right. To which John Mills says, wait, someone's out there trying to kill you and you out here on this little boat with me?
You put me in danger.
Exactly. And Dad is like, I wanted to go fishing. And that's how he went. He was like, I wanted to go fishing. And John Mills died laughing. He was like, wow, okay. But yeah, I mean, that trial, that whole case, you know, was devastating to this area.
Yeah.
Because I know what gets lost in all of that, you know, everybody focusing on these gang of kids and, you know, all the stuff they did, you know, burning down the Coca-Cola bottling company.
Yeah.
And all the stuff. But what gets lost in all of this, and even the remembrances, and I don't know if you saw this, but last summer there was an article with Derek Shields pleading to get out because he's now saying that Foster put him up to it and he was really scared.
He was one
of
the accomplices.
Right. Okay. 20 years later, you're now the victim. Okay. But what's lost in that is that they murdered a teacher.
Yeah.
They murdered a teacher.
Yeah.
They went to Mark Schwiebe's house. Mm-hmm. And because one of them was in band and they knew him, knocked on his door, used that trust to lure him to his death and shot him in the face with a shotgun at point blank range. You know, like I said, I've been in education my entire life, mainly because, you know, I kind of give the short answer. It's the family business. A lot of people know, you know, my father was a judge, but my mother, you know, retired vice president of Florida Gulf Coast. My grandmother was a school teacher. I have several aunts and uncles who were teachers. You know, we can go back generations. We're in education. And I can't think of any greater breach of trust, you know,
mm-hmm.
than to go to your teacher. That just is vile. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely vile.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I just have one last question for you. What is a song that you will always turn off if it comes on the radio and why?
Does it have to be good or bad? That's such a
for any reason.
Man, that's
for any
such a
reason.
Question.
It's layered. It's a layered question.
It's such a question. There's really only one song that – I mean, you know, most music I like. Most music, even if I don't like it, I'll tolerate. But there's one song that it took me years before I could listen to it. And now I won't listen to it because of, you know, just political reasons. But it's called The Same Girl by R. Kelly and there's like another guy in it. But – the reason why is because the year that my father passed away, that summer when I was taking him to chemotherapy every day, you know, top 40 plays, and especially during the summer, the same songs play over and over and over again. and because, you know, my mom was working, my brother's working, I had moved back home to take care of Dad. And this radio, The Same Girl, the song was playing on the radio that summer. One day as we were coming home from chemotherapy – in, as you know, cancer patients will tell you, you know, you get chemo brain and you'll forget things. I mean, that was one of the most difficult things, having to nurse my dad through his illness, is that a man who his whole entire job was listening to arguments and listening to details and remembering everything. I mean, he would forget things after a couple minutes. So that's why it was kind of amazing in this moment where he kind of perks up one day. We're riding home and he says, you know, the song, The Same Girl, is on the radio. And he says, wait a minute, they're dating the same girl? I was like, yeah, Dad, that's what a song's called, Same Girl. And he was like, son of a bitch. I mean, it was this moment where he realized, and he's just like, I can't believe, and he just really had this visceral reaction, you know, and I'm just kind of, yeah, I mean, this is kind of crazy stuff they play on the radio, and like, yeah, whatever. But he just had that moment of clarity and that visceral reaction, and it just tickled me to death. I just couldn't, I was like, yeah, you're right. This is ridiculous. And I tell you, you know, and Dad passed away in 2007. And I tell you, it took almost probably 10 years before, you know, I mean, that song would come. Nope, can't hear that. I just can't, you know. So, but yeah.
All right. Well, any final thoughts?
Final thoughts, you know, my only just a couple. Another group that you'd met or you'd asked about albums and everything, and just thinking about that, my last song with Nas, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Outkast. Because Outkast, I think it's interesting because Nas is because I, you know, was at Princeton University in New Jersey. So it was kind of like that segue into like Northeastern rap and like, you know, obviously Biggie was huge, but like, you know, they had Hot 97 up there out of New York. We don't have stations like that down here. And I was like, what? So I'm like hearing all this Northeast stuff and it's like, whoa, you know, but you know, down here it was, you know, ATLians, like Outkast, like all that, just Outkast. Like I got to give a plug to Outkast, and I definitely got to give a plug to their producer, Midnight Black, who I know in Atlanta, and my buddy Jeff Allen, who works with him. They're amazing. The Dungeon Crew. I've been to the Dungeon, so that's awesome.
Well, cool. I want to thank my guest, Justin Anderson, as a Fort Myers native. He's holder of a bunch of degrees, world traveler, and friend of a friend of mine. Justin, thank you so much for doing this. It's been great getting to know you today over these songs.
Thanks so much for having me.
We make Three Song Stories in the studios of WGCU Public Radio on the campus of Florida Gulf Coast University in Fort Myers, Florida. Richard Chinqui is our show's producer, director, and co-creator. Tara Callaghan and Anna Bay Hirano produce our online content. Chris Duffus is our executive producer. Today's episode was directed by Tara Saleya, and our theme music was created by Dave Cowan and Stick Martin at Monkey House Studio in St. Pete. Hey, listeners, we really want your song stories. If you've got a song that takes you back to a memory, record your story onto your phone. Send it to mysongstory@wgcu.org. We are running out of parting tunes, so want to get your voices and stories onto future episodes of Three Song Stories. For my parting tune this week, I'm going back to yesterday in the production booth of this studio. During Gulf Coast Live, which I produce with our co-creator Richard, we somehow got to talking about the way music used to be recorded versus the heavily produced efforts you hear a lot of these days. And that reminded me of a song by Ani DiFranco because of a line in it, which I recited for Richard. Well, this is one of the first songs that made my, at the time, probably 10-year-old daughter perk up her ears and get instantly hooked. Besides Moxie Fruvis, of course. Well, it's also the first song by her that caught my ear back in the late 90s. And besides yesterday and a few years ago with Gwen, my story is not about this song necessarily, but about Ani herself. I was walking down the sidewalk in Manhattan in the early 2000s, and what do you know, but there she was, walking toward me with a purpose. She had an instantly recognizable bearing and stature and demeanor. I tried not to notice, but looked over and gave her a half smile and a nod, which she returned as we passed, and it thrilled me because I just don't think she's cool. I know she's super cool. So this is the song Fuel by Ani DiFranco from her 1998 album Little Plastic Castle, which I highly recommend. I'm Mike Canary. Keep listening.
Next time on Three Song Stories.
You get in your stub, you check your
ticket stub and get a check back. For your $10, you could get a refund. So I did that, and I got a check back from Led Zeppelin, and I didn't frame
it.
I cashed it. I can't believe it. It's the great regret of my life.